This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Green and Bold Podcast. My name is Joe Stiglich. Alongside me, as always, my partner in crime, David Feldman. David, good to talk to you again. It's been a while since we've been on the podcast here, sharing our thoughts on the A's with folks, but it's good to be back. How have you been, first of all?
I've been well, Joe. How have you been?
I've been doing pretty good. doing some teaching at San Jose State a little bit, but the semester's wrapped up. Journalism students are off doing their thing for the summer.
Nice.
Back to podcasting some baseball here. So it's good to see you again. Good to see you virtually. Great to talk to you. Let's get into it here. Talk about this A's team a little bit. Since last time you and I got together, I would say this A's team is hold and serve pretty well, is the way I would say it. Now, they're hold and serve in the American League West. As we speak right now, 35-26 record. They're one game up on those Houston Astros, who we know are never going to go away in that American League West. I think like every team, the A's have withstood some injuries and still stay in the course, though. And I think a lot of things you like offensively and pitching-wise with this team. Maybe some things you don't like too, but I'm just curious, kind of big picture, kind of sum up for me how you feel about this A's team right now and how it sits at the beginning of it, what's going to be a 9-game homestand here.
It was really hard to think that the A's have played 61 games. So last year they played 60.
This season would be over right now in 2020.
Over. It kind of blows your mind how fast that is and how the 60 games really presented perspective. So normally at this point, you are gone through 2 months of a season and you kind of have evaluated your team and you spend the next 2 months tinkering and changing the roster and looking for ways to really make that stretch run. And the last 2 months is what you want your team to be. So this is really the reflecting time for the A's and you go, okay, terrible beginning of the season, 0-6, 1-7, 13 game win streak. You take those two things as they are. They weren't as bad as the 1-7. They weren't as good as the 13-0. And since then, they've played, since the winning streak, they've played a little above 500, not much. And they kind of are what they are, right? At this point, they rely on the home run, probably too much. They have some holes in the bullpen. You have some players who are having down years for now. Again, it's only been 2 months. And you don't really have anybody having a career year or a year that's carrying this team. And this team is not built to rely on one player, it really isn't. So when I look at these first 61 games, I just see a team that kind of is what it is. It's a good team. Can it be better? It can be. Can it go south? Yeah, there's a chance that this could go south pretty quickly as well. So there are some things that have to happen for this team to continue, especially when you're battling against the Houston Astro team, who I think is offensively definitely much better than the A's are.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think we came in, we thought this is going to be a two-team race, right, in the American League West. To this point, it's playing out that way so far. We know those Astros aren't going anywhere. They have an ability to run off a big winning streak at any time here, and they're right on the A's heels right now. And, yeah, the A's got to find some consistency and or keep up that consistency and keep it going here. You know, they're coming off this road trip, and I know part of the road trip was in Coors Field, where offense always goes up, but I was encouraged a little bit that they diversified a little bit their ability to score. It seemed like it wasn't so reliant on the long ball, and I think part of that was the bottom of the batting order coming alive a little bit. Some guys that we haven't been talking about too much offensively this year are giving them a little bit of a spark. You know, top of the lineup, Mark Canna, we've talked about him. I mean, how good has he been? This whole experiment in the leadoff spot with Mark Canna has really turned out as well or better than the A's could have expected with what they're getting from him, I think, at the top. The on-base ability, leading the majors in runs scored. We know the pop that he's got in his bat, you know, and you look at, Matt Olson continuing to just round into an all-around hitter. What an all-around hitter Matt Olson's become, right? His ability to go to the opposite field, raise that average a little bit. Just definitely, I think, the most feared guy in the lineup from an opposing pitcher standpoint, probably, Matt Olson. But then at the bottom of the order recently, I mean, Tony Kemp giving him some production. Elvis Andrews starting to hit a little bit, seeing a little bit of life offensively from Elvis Andrews. Obviously, guys like Seth Brown, Sean Murphy chipping in. No Ramon Laureano right now. It's a big hole in the lineup. But kind of impressed with what I'm seeing from the lineup overall. And it's sort of masking a little bit what we're not seeing from Matt Chapman, if you notice. I mean, obviously it's been a really slow start for Matt Chapman. And the fact that A's are still hanging in there offensively without one of their major impact bats really doing anything, I think is a positive sign for this team right now. But offensively, that's the way I see it. But you're right, they are reliant on the long ball overall. It's nice to see them string together some hits, string together some big innings like we saw in this past road trip.
Yeah, I've been very, very excited by the play of Elvis Andrus. I mean, he's now been hitting over 300 for almost a month and hitting with a little harder contact. And he's, you know, that first month he was like having the pitcher hit at the bottom of the order, right? He was just an out. And he wasn't, even when he made contact, it wasn't going anywhere. That's changed. Now we're starting to see a little bit more exit velocity, hitting for a higher average, being a factor. We see him on the bases. We see him steal two runs at third base, you know, one causing a balk in Boston and then getting into a rundown in Minnesota and causing a collision with a little bit of a flopperoo there and got a run out of it. And that's the veteran guiles of Elvis Andrus. Tony Kemp has become an on-base machine. And his on-base average as we speak is 391. And now his batting average is starting to move up. Right now he's at 287. But that on-base has pretty much stayed there because even when he wasn't hitting early, he was walking. He was being a factor in the bottom of the order. So those two guys, Kemp's forced his way in the lineup, right? Even with Laureano out, you're seeing Kemp getting those at-bats, really. You brought up Seth Brown. And here's a guy who I think is fooling a lot of people. Seth Brown is one for his last 25. He had some nice moments. I mean, he's got 8 home runs, and he's shown some power. But now there's a book out on him, and you're starting to see Seth Brown struggle. And he's hitting a 195 average. And he's not being a factor out there. But he fools you because he has those kind of those moments. And you think he's playing a lot better than he is. And that's a question mark for me, is Seth Brown. And here's a frustration for me. And the A's do this, and I don't understand it. They will call up a hot hitter from the minors. They did this earlier with Luis Barrera. They did this with Skybolt. Skybolt was red hot in Vegas. His last 10 games playing there, hitting almost 500 on base 80% of the time. They call him up, and they don't play him. They didn't play Luis Barrera. They didn't play Skybolt. I don't understand that thinking. When you have a hot hitter, yes, it's at the minor league level, but other teams you see, they get him right in the lineup. Because what happens if you don't? That player now sits, and now he sits and has to think about it. And now he goes another day without playing, and another day without playing, and another day. You know, it's not putting that player in the best position to succeed. And I would just like to see when you have a hot hitter in the minors, like Skybolt was, bring him up, put him in the lineup, and let's see what happens. And the A's, for some reason, don't do that. And then continually, here we are, Seth Brown getting at bats. It's an irritant for me for what this organization does sometimes with young players.
Not only was Seth Brown getting at bats, he was hitting cleanup sometimes. We actually saw him in the cleanup spot a little bit, right? That's a sign of how much Bob Melvin was trying to shake things up at times, trying to get that offense going a little bit. We saw a lot of different lineups, a lot of different looks towards the top of the order, too. You're talking about Seth Brown. He fools us a little bit. Is part of it because of his background? We know he wasn't a heralded guy, and we know that he really had to, you know, broke through a couple of years ago, and then it was kind of disappeared back in the minors for a little bit. Now he's back, and it always seems like he's an underdog, right? It always seems like when he does succeed, wow, it's almost like found money. Well, we're getting production from Seth Brown and everything. And maybe it does seem like he's doing more, a little bit more than he actually is probably. I think might be part of it too.
Well, it kind of happened in 2019 when he first came up. You know, when he first came up, he's hitting doubles like crazy. You know, he's hitting 370 or whatever. And then you look at his last 8 games of the season, he goes 0 for 19 or 0 for 20. Maybe just teams just sort of figure him out. And this is what has happened here. And it's nothing against Seth Brown. You're right. He has never been this heralded guy. He has these big moments, walk-off home run or a big home run here and, you know, nice game defensively. And you think that he's playing maybe better than he is. Nothing against Seth Brown. It kind of leads into the Stephen Biscotti talk, right? Because Stephen Biscotti's on this team. You might have forgotten that. You know, he doesn't get to play every day. And then you look at his numbers and you go, well, that, he's not so good. Well, he doesn't play. You look at the last time that he played really every day was in 2018, right? And you go, he had 27 homers. He hit 41 doubles. He had an OPS over 800. This was a quality player. So my opinion now is it's either you got to play Stephen Piscotty and give him a chance to play every day versus lefties and righties, because you're not really gaining much not playing him right now. Or it's time to move Stephen Piscotty and try and get something for him, because you got to see what you have there. And by not playing him or playing him sporadically, you're killing his what trade value he does have for some teams, because they're seeing someone not at his peak.
Yeah, that's true. We've talked about Piscotty before. Is he, if he's not going to be an instrumental part of this team, maybe put him on the trade block a little bit deeper in the episode. Not too long from now, we're going to talk about some trade targets that we like. Reaching to pick a player, conceivable trade target maybe for the A's with this trade deadline coming up a little bit maybe. How much do you start paying attention to the trade rumors right now? Do you start kind of keen in on it right now and the rumor mill starts picking up a little bit? We don't know how much. I mean, there's some people who think there's not going to be a whole lot of trade activity maybe this summer like prior summers, but we're getting to that point where it's time to start watching and thinking about who might be buyers, who might be sellers right now. It's kind of that fun part of the season as far as speculation goes, especially when you're, you know, following and rooting for a team like the A's, who were very much anticipating to be buyers. You know, who could they be adding? But it's getting that time. It's almost rumor season right now, right?
It
seems like
it is. And you got to keep your ears open, right? Because you start hearing names and then you start having an idea of who might be out there and what teams are looking for. There are some bad teams in baseball right now who will be looking to move players because they really have no hope. So you pay attention to that. Yeah, this is, again, this 2 months, really, the, you know, June and July, that's when you're really trying to decide how you're going to put this team together come August and September. So this is really the time to start paying attention.
Probably tougher teams right now, too. There have been so many injuries in the major leagues this year. So many teams are so banged up right now, and teams are trying to figure out probably how much are we going to get, how much should we rely on the health, returning health of some players, and how much are they going to be factors if they come back 100%? How much do we have to be proactive and go out and bring somebody in right now? But the injuries across the game are – that's a topic for a whole other podcast. But holy cow, I don't know if it was a short season last year. Now guys ramping up at spring training and trying to get ready for this marathon season they're back to. But whatever it is, injuries across the game have been – it's crazy how many guys have been out. A lot of big names too.
Big names and teams have just been – you know, you look at their injured list, and there's 10, 12 guys on it. The A's have been – relatively healthy.
Relatively speaking, that's not always something to say for the A's on the injury front year after year, but relatively speaking, maybe not as bad off as a lot of other teams.
No, I mean, you like to see Ramon Laureano get back healthy and back to playing. He's a big spark plug for this team. We know the energy and the emotion, not to say just the ability that he brings to this ball club. The A's have done a nice job in this last week without him. You don't want to go too much further. So hopefully his get back quickly to good health so he can play. You know, Mike Fiers, you know, it just might be one of those years where you don't see Mike Fiers. That's unfortunate, but, you know, James Caprillion has come up and he's filling in that role nicely right now. Cole Irvin looks like he's been a steal in the offseason to bring him in. And Dalton Jeffries, there's only been a couple starts now for Vegas. He's going to make another one tomorrow on Tuesday. But he looks like Dalton Jeffries looked when we saw him last year and in 2019, that he can be a major league pitcher. So the A's can afford to Mike Fiers, not to have Mike Fiers, put it that way. I mean, if he gets healthy again, great. But that hasn't been a detrimental injury.
I'd agree with you there. We're talking about the trade market a little bit. Why don't we just shift into that right now? We thought it'd be fun for each of us to kind of pick a player, target a player that we think makes sense for this 2021 A's team. A realistic get, right? A realistic get. Somebody they could go after that makes sense to fit in this team right now to help make another push for another second straight division title. So let's get into it, Phil. I'm curious to see who you might come up with.
Okay.
You're the A's right now. Give me a player.
I might have cheated. I might have come up with two guys because there was some other guy came up a little later today.
Okay.
But this is the guy that I think could actually really – help the A's, and that's in the bullpen. And the A's have been very good about going out and getting bullpen arms. We saw it, obviously the best example was 2018 when you got Fernando Rodney and Gerald Fermin and really making the game shorter which was important that year. But the A's are a little light on the left side. Adam Kolarik doesn't look like he's going to work out. He wasn't great at the major league level. He had Las Vegas. Not that many A's pitchers have been great in Las Vegas. Your other left-hander down there, AJ Puck, has not been great in Las Vegas. His velocity's down. He's getting hit. Not sure what his status is. And right now you have Jesus Luzardo in the bullpen. And I like Jesus Luzardo in the bullpen. I like the idea of a multi-inning reliever who can come out and really pitch 6-7-8 or 7-8-9 or just 7-8, whatever it takes. I like that. But Lizardo's future is as a starter, and I think he's going to be more valuable as a starter. So helping out with a left-handed reliever, I think, needs to be one of the A's priority. And then there's a lot of left-handed guys, but one guy who was really good last year and is even better this year, probably a name a lot of people don't even know, that's Paul Fry. He's a left-handed reliever with the Orioles. And again, you got to look at sort of the lesser teams who have been willing to make moves. And Paul Fry's in his fourth big league season. This year, he's got an ERA of 1.99, a whip of just 1.06, doesn't walk a lot of guys, 33 strikeouts and 22 and two-thirds innings. He's even saved a couple games in the closer role for the Orioles. I think this is a left-handed reliever that could really help Flex. And a guy, because he's been on the Orioles in the, you know, Eastern Division, Western teams haven't seen him. They didn't see him at all last year. Right, because we were all in this division makeup. We only played your own division. So you have the unknown factor along with Paul Fry. So I really like this is somebody I think Baltimore would be willing to trade. He's going to be arbitration eligible. For the A's, it's somebody you're going to have for multi-years. And he's been very good. He's been a good left-handed reliever. He doesn't give up home runs. He doesn't walk guys. That's what I like in a reliever.
Paul Fry. I like it. I like it. We're thinking the same on the same brainwave as far as the area of the team that could use some upgrading. Now, you've got two guys, right?
I have one other little sneaky guy.
Okay, I'll go ahead and give you one name, and then we'll go back to you for your trade target number two. But I'm with you on the bullpen front. I stuck with a right-hander, and I wasn't thinking too much righty-lefty need, although there is more of probably an immediate need as far as balance for left-hander type reliever. I'm going to Ian Kennedy. Reliever for the Texas Rangers, who's actually closing for the Rangers right now. You know, Ian Kennedy, I think when I first hear the name Ian Kennedy, I still think starting pitcher.
Sure.
Back when he was a young guy for the Yankees, kind of an up-and-coming guy too. But back in 2019 is when Kennedy kind of made the switch to the bullpen with Kansas City and really doing a nice job for the Rangers this year. They say his fastball velocity is up a little bit. Walk rate is down. Striking out over 10 per nine innings right now. A veteran guy who I think could really kind of give this bullpen a boost. Where does he fit in? Maybe he's a closer for you. Maybe he's just another late inning arm. But I think if you add somebody, a veteran guy, proven guy like this, it just lengthens out that bullpen a little bit. And I think we probably agree that A's bullpen can use some lengthening a little bit. There's some guys that maybe we'd like to see not be out there so much, maybe not get exposed so much, maybe. Add another arm like that. I like Ian Kennedy. And, you know, Feldy, I think part of this plays into you brought up Jesus Luzardo. Where do we see him fitting in the rest of this season? Because if you like him in the bullpen, I like him in the bullpen too. I like the way he's able to kind of let loose and just let that fastball just, you know, pump 97, 98 consistently whenever he's out there. And working in the breaking pitches too a little bit, get that mix going. I think it's great. And if you're willing to leave him in the bullpen, maybe that's that left-handed addition that you need, a guy that can eat up innings too. Maybe you can use them in some different ways, you know, but you got to come in whether the game's tied in the middle innings, whether you need him to hold on to a lead. You know, you get a short outing from a starter, you need a little bit of length from your bullpen. Luzardo can be that guy. But speaking to your point that his future's as a starter, I think we still could see him back in the rotation before this season's over. You know, Caprellian's look very good. He's a young guy. We don't know what we're going to get from him moving forward. Cole Irvin's, I think, has come down to earth a little bit. I love what we're seeing from him. We're getting so much more. The A's are getting so much more from Cole Irvin than they could have expected. But is he going to be an every fifth day guy the whole season long? We'll see. So I think maybe if Luzardo finds his confidence, finds his rhythm in the bullpen, maybe he eventually goes back to the rotation. I bring that up because as inconsistent as the A's can be offensively sometimes, I was looking at a lot of starting pitchers too for as trade targets potentially to bolster this bullpen or this rotation. As good as rotation has been, I think attrition is a factor. I think you can use another rotation arm. So I think Lizardo could maybe go back into that rotation eventually, which means bullpen depth is needed too. That's why Ian Kennedy, I think, you know, made the Rangers this year on a minor league deal. He's making $2.15 million, I think, this year on a one-year deal. He's an affordable guy. He's a free agent at season's end. So I like a veteran guy like that. It seems like the A's are always looking to beef up that bullpen midseason. And he's a guy I like maybe as an addition right there, Ian Kennedy from the Rangers. Dealing within the division, you know, Texas, they're trying to rebuild. They probably take a young pitching prospect. The A's have some to deal from. I think they could be a potential trade partner for the A's maybe.
Yeah, I like that. I actually thought of Ian Kennedy last year when the A's were looking to add on at the end. Because he had 30 saves for the Royals in 2019. This is a guy who once won 20 games. He won 20 games with the Diamondbacks 10 years ago. He was a good starting pitcher. He's turned himself into this closer now. I think Ian Kennedy would be very much a good addition to this A's bullpen. I think he stacks the end of the game. I'm so worried about wearing guys out. Yeah. And it's been nice this last week. You know, you got a complete game from Bassett and you got a complete game from Manaea. You had the help from Lizardo doing multiple innings with the lead. Because right now your trust in the bullpen is Petit, Diekman, and Trevino. And that's it, right? And you gotta be careful with Petit. You can't overuse him. You don't want him to pitch, you know, get out of a jam and then bring him back the next inning. That doesn't seem to work. You know, Diekman is frustrating as he always is. And Trevino's still learning how to be a closer. So having a veteran guy to add to that and help lengthen that bullpen, I really like. You know, Birch Smith is good now that he's healthy, but he's only good for one inning. You see when you bring him out for the second, things normally don't go well. You have to be really careful with Romo, right? Romo, if he's got too many left-handed hitters coming up, you're going to have a problem. And again, you don't want to pitch Romo a second inning. If you get away with one inning, you're very excited. Don't push it with him. There's just not enough trust with some of these guys. I wish the A's would use Cam Bedrosian a little bit more. He's pitched well in the limited times we've seen him. Now, again, most of the times we've seen the lesser guys are when the A's are trailing. So the pressure is a little different, but they've done a good job. But you're going to wear out your top three guys unless you get them some help. And so I think Ian Kennedy actually would be a big plus to this bullpen.
But if you're the HGM, you have another target. You've got a target number two that you like. I want to hear who that man is right now.
I do. I have somebody who this would be an A's type of pickup because it'd be a total gamble. And maybe you get lucky with this. And it's a left-handed swinging outfielder that the A's know very well from his day with the Angels. Now he's with the Diamondbacks and he's hurt. And that's Cole Calhoun.
A's killer, Cole Calhoun.
Cole Calhoun with 33 homers in 2019 for the Angels, a Gold Glove winner. Can play right field. Now, he had a hamstring surgery back at the end of April where they actually took out a tendon. This is when I was reading about it, it's much more regular surgery for a football player. This is the first known baseball player to have this, but it's supposed to help with recovery and obviously stop pulled hamstrings. 6 to 8 weeks recovery time. So that puts him back about the end of June. He's on the 60-day IL for the Diamondbacks. He's in the last year of a two-year deal. He's not making that much money. Diamondbacks have no need for him, really. I think they would be willing to move Cole Calhoun. The A's could take a gamble on trading for an injured guy, which they've done before. It's not, you know, James Caprillion was coming off Tommy John when they included him in the trade, the Sonny Gray trade. But if you think that Cole Calhoun can be healthy by the end of July, right, and can be a force for the last 2 months of the season and be better than Seth Brown or better than Sky Bolt, maybe you make that deal. Maybe you make that gamble to bring in a veteran left-handed swinger who can hit with power, can field this position. I kind of like that gamble.
You know, look at his numbers last year, only 54 games in the abbreviated season, right? 864 OPS, though, which is impressive, even a short body work like last season was. Playing at 33 years old right now. So he's been around a long time, but he's not over the hill by any means either. So you would think this is a guy maybe you could pick up for not too steep of a price. And who knows, last year of his contract, maybe he shows you something and maybe he's a guy that makes sense even moving forward, possibly bring him back. Maybe, who knows? Interesting. That is interesting. And it's an outside the box idea for a guy who's not in the picture right now and like not physically 100%, like you're saying.
I like it as an A's move. I think it's a gamble worth taking. Historically, people have come back from this injury and have been able to play just fine. Again, baseball players, we don't know. This is a football player injury or football type surgery. But Cole Calhoun, big, strong guy. I like it. I just like that idea of taking a gamble on something. And then a month after you acquire him, let's say you acquire him at the end of June, he gets to go play at Las Vegas for a few weeks and he gets ready. And then he adds, it's like, it's a huge addition to get a player of that caliber to add to your roster.
No doubt. Now, a couple episodes ago, you brought up Trevor Story. I thought that was a really cool idea. Back before the trade rumors were really heating up a lot, Trevor Story being a possible target. He is still on the DL. I don't think he's been activated, but he's expected to be activated any time now, I believe, off the injured list. Elbow injury, I believe he had, if I remember right, for Trevor Story. I think it's an elbow for him. I'm trying to remember.
Let me double check real quick. He is on right elbow inflammation.
Yeah, he's about to come off the injured list. Everybody anticipates, and thought is if he shows he's healthy and comes back, hasn't had the most productive season as far as the back of his baseball card right now, not putting up huge numbers. But he has been hurt too. Looked at as one of the prime trade candidates, one of the more marquee names that could be on the trade market. Maybe we'll see if the Rockies are willing to deal him. But you were hot on the Trevor Story idea for as a potential trade target. And I mean, on the surface, it could still make sense. Let me ask you, with Elvis Andrews showing a little more offensive life lately, does it kind of make you look at a potential Trevor Story acquisition any differently now? The fact that they're getting a little bit of production, a little bit from Elvis Andrews recently now.
No, I think if there's an opportunity to add a player of Trevor Story's ilk, I think you make that move.
I think so too.
He is a tremendous offensive player when he's right, and he's a tremendous defensive player. You know, one thing that we don't talk about enough with the A's, because it doesn't look like it hurts them as much as it really does, is their defense. According to Baseball Info Solutions, they are the worst at defensive run saves in the majors. And the biggest issue is second and short. And if you watch the A's on a daily basis, you do see it. They don't turn double plays that are not started by Matt Chapman. Matt Chapman starts the double play, they turn it. But when it's Lowry or Elvis, they don't turn those double plays. They're slow. Elvis and Lowry are slow. And Kemp is not a great second baseman. He's an okay second baseman who can make a spectacular play from time to time.
All right, I want to apologize for a couple of technical issues we had there. Feldy, you were talking about Trevor Story a little bit. I'm going to let you continue talking about Mr. Story. Go for it.
Well, just in conclusion, being able to add a player of Trevor Story's quality would be an upgrade. And the A's should look into adding him to their ball club. I just feel that Trevor Story is going to be such a hot commodity on the trade market that his price might be a little too high for the A's. He might bring back more than what the A's are able to give for him, but they should be in the bidding for him. I think it would be a smart move and a huge upgrade for the A's to get a player like Trevor Story.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we've talked about, he is just a rental. So maybe a team's not going to have to give up quite as much, but I think you're right. There's going to be a lot of teams in the bidding process maybe. So maybe that drives up the asking price a little bit. And the Rockies may have their choice of teams perhaps. So we're talking here about potential trade pieces, what could be added to this roster. Let's talk a little bit, David, about the man who kind of makes this roster work, right? Who makes all the calls and the in-game decisions especially and gets his lineup going and everything. Bob Melvin, who just last week on the last road trip notched win number 799 to pass Tony La Russa for being the winningest manager in Oakland history. Number two now on the franchise list behind Connie Mack, way behind Connie Mack, but Bob Melvin is now the all-time winningest manager in Oakland history. And something to be celebrated. You know, since then he's gotten win number 800 and in an A's uniform. And Phil, let's talk about Bob Melvin a little bit. Been here since the middle of 2011, won two Manager of the Year awards now just with the A's. He also won one in the National League with the Diamondbacks. But when we look at Bob Melvin, kind of, he's been here so long now. We just talk about overall strengths of him, what makes him a good manager and what makes him a successful leader in the dugout that he is. What are some of the attributes you see when you talk about Bob Melvin in this A's tenure?
It's amazing to think that it's been 10 years since the A's hired him. We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary. His first game was the 9th of June of 2011 in Chicago. And when the A's hired him, they needed to replace Bob Guerin. It's amazing to think since Tony La Russa was hired as the A's manager on July 7th, 1986, 1986, the A's have only had five managers, right? Tony through the 95 season, very successful. Art Howe from 96 through 02, very successful. So rocky beginning. He had some bad teams at the beginning of 97 lost team, but then the talent picked up and he was able to turn that club into a winner. Ken Maka, who continued with Art Howe, did not end well with Ken Maka. And that's really why they got Bob Guerin. But Bob Guerin was not the right manager. He was not a good manager in many different ways, dealing with the team, dealing with the media, and dealing with the strategy of baseball. He failed across the board. Bob Melvin came in. He had a track record, right, with the Mariners and the Diamondbacks, but he had been out of baseball. He was scouting for the Yankees. And it turned out to be the perfect fit. You know, to be the A's manager, and Art Howe was so good at this. Tony La Russa was, and he still is since he's back managing, is very much that old school, the clubhouse, the lineup card, anything that happens on the field is mine. It's my domain. It's my kingdom. Yeah, I will work with Sandy Alderson in the front office on roster makeup, but I have the final say. Well, after Tony left and Art Howe came in, that's when front offices started having more control in what the roster was like and what the starting lineup was like. Not right away, but there were times where Art Howe and Billy Beane did not get along very well because of decisions that Art was making that went against what Billy was recommending. There was tension there. And then, you know, with Ken Maka and Bob Guerin, it really became the front office started to control things. So Bob Melvin comes in and he was the perfect fit to work between the two, to still be in control of the clubhouse, to have some control of the lineup card, not all of it, but at least to always communicate with the players what was happening. And that's the one thing you always see now, these stories being written about Bob Melvin, is his communication with the players. He was always communicative. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that he was a backup catcher in the big leagues who probably didn't get talked to a lot, probably didn't get told when he was going to play or when he was not going to play. And he didn't want anyone to go through that. And as a manager, he just fit in perfectly with this clubhouse. You know, you think back to the early 2000 with the Jason Giambi and Tim Hudson and Jason Isringhausen. This was a fun-loving frat house style clubhouse. And that has sort of continued where you're able to be your own person in the A's clubhouse. And Bob Melvin enjoys that, being a Bay Area kid himself. He's for that. He understands the game. He understands people. You got to deal with him on a daily basis. So you know as well as anyone what it's like to deal with Bob Melvin as a manager.
Yeah, you mentioned communication. That was the big thing when he first came in. The communication is what I know a lot of players in the clubhouse noticed. And you're right. The feeling was that was lacking under Bob Guerin. The communication, players knowing, especially bullpen roles, how they might be used, how they could expect to get ready and everything. And that was a weak point under Bob Guerin. And when Bob Melvin came in, immediately communication was a strength of his. And you're right. He's been here 10 plus years, but I still think back to it. It doesn't feel like it's been that long because I have such vivid memories of covering the team that day when the switch was made, right? The team was coming off a long losing streak, going from Camden Yards to Chicago to play the White Sox. And overnight was when we kind of find out, well, early the next morning, we found out the managerial move was going to be made to Bob Melvin. I still remember him the first game at US Cellular Field, kind of on the top of the dugout steps, just clapping and really just being kind of cheerleader and rah-rah like. But that was an extension of the enthusiasm he was feeling then. And I kind of feel like that enthusiasm has never really gone away. You know, he's not nearly as demonstrative when you see him in the dugout now. But when you hear Bob Melvin talk after games and the way he talks about his players, Bob is his player's biggest fan.
Yeah.
Nobody's a bigger fan of his players than the manager himself. And that's not to say he's a rah-rah guy just looking to, you know, cozy up to the players. He's very much his own man. You know, he's the authoritative leader of that clubhouse. But there's a positivity he exudes that players appreciate, I think. He's a great communicator, no doubt about that. And he's had the ability to win with a lot of different personalities in this clubhouse and win under a lot of different expectations, too. He's had teams like the past couple of years are expected to do really well, and he's delivering victories. And he's had teams like the 2012 team, which is his first full season, which seemed like a complete rebuild, right? They
yes.
traded so many players that offseason before 2012 and turned him into a surprise division winner. So he's proved very adaptable, I think, to that. And but always, he's always got it in mind to make players comfortable, keep players comfortable, put them in the best position to succeed. And especially veteran players right now, I can tell you right now from the conversations I had with him that first year in 2011, when he took over, he had a veteran team that was not playing very well. For all the veterans they had, it was a team going nowhere in the standings. And a lot of people were thinking, well, now's the time they're going to turn the page. They're going to play all young players, you know, and conversations I had with him, he was saying, I mean, Bob knew that there's no quicker way for a clubhouse to turn toxic than to have a bunch of veteran players kind of get bitter by all of a sudden benching them. That's why players like Hideki Matsui continued to play. David DeJesus continued to play a little bit. If you remember, Feldy, Matsui was not having a good year. He was a marquee signing for the A's that year in 2011, but he wasn't having a great year. Bob came in as manager and installed him as a number three hitter. Yeah. I can't remember how long that he hit number three for, and I don't think it had a huge impact, but Bob came in and said, you know what? This is a veteran guy. He's my guy. This is the kind of guy I want hitting number three in the lineup. That was just the respect that he showed players like that. I think that's just an indication of his style of managing. When he came in, he was going to make sure the veteran players were happy, at least given a chance to succeed, whether or not they took advantage of it or not. But no, he's a great communicator. Go ahead.
That's just part of it. Knowing the players and thinking about the players and how those decisions affect you. And not to rip again on Bob Guerin, but you know, in 2008, Mike Sweeney joined the club, right? This was when the A's were really trying to get that right-handed DH. They struck gold with Frank Thomas in 06. They brought in Mike Piazza in 07. And now we're trying it with Sweeney in 08. And Sweeney was a great Kansas City Royal. And now the A's are making their first trip to Kansas City. Sweeney's first trip back. It's a big moment. And he's not in the lineup. It's just, you got to read the room, man. And it's just, no one could believe it. And the looks around the club, it was painful to watch. And that would never happen with Bob Melvin. We'll give you an idea just recently. It was ALS night. It was Lou Gehrig day. And the A's were playing in Seattle and they're facing a right-handed pitcher. Normally, Stephen Piscotty, as we talked about, has not been playing against right-handed pitchers. Stephen Piscotty was in the lineup. It was ALS night. It's an important part of the Piscotty's family now and his goals and what they're trying to do. And he made sure Piscotty's playing. Little thing, but it pays off so far in one game. One game to put him in the lineup that he might not play, but it pays off down the road. And that's who Bob Melvin is. Now, we talk about with the front office, and they do make some decisions. And you see some things happen in games, and you go, oh, Bob. Well, sometimes his hands are tied. Sometimes he's got to toe the company line and do what is told of him. And that's where, again, the communication comes in with the players. And I think he's very straight up with his players saying, hey, this is what the club has decided it's best. So they know that they're not surprised. And fans and media might be surprised by some of the things, players never seem to be.
Yeah, and smart in his comments in the media, says the right things, gives the front office a lot of praise and gives the analytic department a lot of praise and says all the right things and kind of embraces that part of it too. You know, instead of being a manager who, you know, acts like that's a hindrance to him and there's some meddling going on, makes it into a positive, says all the right things about those situations. And you're right, does the balancing act between having the authority and leadership of that clubhouse and having the players respect and trust and being able to work with the front office too and take all the input and the information he gets from them and trying to put that to the best use too. So no, he does a great job doing that balancing act, and he's been doing it for a long time. You know, he's happy being in the spot, a Bay Area guy who loves his Bay Area history too, loves all the Bay Area teams, very present at all the Cal games. He went to Cal himself. Yep. So at a lot of Cal events, back when Mark Jackson was coaching the Warriors, Mark Jackson was over talking to Melvin during batting practice and everything. So he's got those Bay Area ties and just he's the right fit, just a good fit to be coaching this Bay Area franchise for so long now.
He is. And you know, he's missing one thing from his resume, his Hall of Fame resume, I should say. And that's the World Series.
Yep.
Because he, outside of that, he has a World Series resume, winning percentage of 515, almost 1,300 wins now. Lots of playoff appearances. You know, he went to the playoffs with the Diamondbacks in 07, a team that had a negative run differential, still made it to the postseason. He had a 93 win year with the Mariners. They just missed the postseason that year. Obviously, six trips with the A's. So it's all there. It's just that the golden ticket, right? The World Series. Maybe even just reaching the World Series might be enough. But if he was to add a World Series title to his resume, he is, for me, a sure shot Hall of Famer.
I think you're right. I think the credentials are there, and I think he would be. I think he would be, and that is the one thing missing right now. We'll see if he can get that crowning achievement in his managerial career, because he's been in the playoffs plenty of times with the A's, and it looks like he's got a team right now that's got potential to make another run to the postseason. We'll see how that works out. Philly, I think one of the last things we need to touch on here, since we last did a podcast, we saw some news break about the A's and potential relocation. Are they going to – they're looking at Las Vegas now. Could they potentially leave Oakland? What's going on with Howard Terminal and all this, Feldy? It's nothing new for fans of Oakland sports.
No.
It's nothing new for Oakland A's fans, that's for sure. And whenever you hear talk of relocation, no matter what team it is, no matter what sport it is, one individual kind of comes into focus as kind of the villain figure, at least in fans' minds, kind of the villain. And I think, in all fairness, I think you'd say that person right now for a lot of the A's fan base would be their president, Dave Cavill. And, you know, in a way, from a certain standpoint, that's very surprising considering when Dave Cavill came on at the end of 2016, kind of the what he represented at that point, the rooted in Oakland slogan came into fruition not long after that. Dave started the office hours. He was so fan friendly. It seemed like he was the ally of the Oakland A's fan. And he was the guy who was going to truly lead the effort to keep this team, to build a ballpark in Oakland and keep this team in Oakland. And Dave was at the forefront of that. And I think he was a champion of the fans. The fans felt he was a champion of the franchise. This is our guy. He's got us in mind. He's got the fan in mind, always an open door policy. And now recent weeks, that's really kind of changed with the tweet that we all saw from the Las Vegas Golden Knights game, talking about kind of, hey, everybody, look how great, you know, this crowd is in Las Vegas, kind of seemed like rubbing it in the nose of A's fans that he was kind of being courted by Las Vegas. Kind of, you know, in a Twitter battle with Bay Area media, San Francisco media a little bit too. So just kind of, what are your thoughts on kind of the way maybe Dave Cavill's portrayed right now, or viewed, I should say, maybe by the A's fan base?
Yeah, he really became the villain right away. And that tweet kind of sealed it. That's, you know, when you become the face, at least the public face of the franchise, which he did when he became president, you know, Mike Crowley before him, he was not a public figure. Lou Wolf was not, it was more Billy Bean was, but that's a baseball side. Cavill took over as president and became the business side. And like you said, rooted in Oakland, what we're going to do and get the ballpark, everything. Cavill, very positive, built the stadium in San Jose for the Earthquakes. He was the guy to get the job done. And, you know, a couple of missteps. The Peralta site was not handled well publicly. Public relations wise, it didn't work out very well. Power Terminal was Libby Schaff in the city of Oakland. That's what they pushed for. And the A's seemed determined to make that work. And they gotten further than any stadium project has ever gotten. Up to this point, the environmental review and then this vote and the term sheet. I mean, no, we've never gotten this far. But then, you know, Major League Baseball comes in with their statement about, well, this is moving too slow for us. Maybe the A's should look for other options. And Cavill kind of jumped aboard with that and said, yeah, we're going to go. We're going to go look in Vegas. There was rumors about Portland. They've denied that the A's have ever talked to Portland or they're going to Portland. But Vegas was for sure. They did the fact-finding mission in Vegas. There's no waterfront in Vegas to build a waterfront stadium. I thought that was really important to the team. Those are these inconsistencies that we keep hearing. We hear the Coliseum is not a viable site. That's what Major League Baseball said. And the A said, well, Major League Baseball said it, then I guess it's not. Although the Blue Ribbon Committee from years ago said the Coliseum was the most viable site to build a stadium. So what is real? What is not? What is posturing? What is not? What upset me about the tweet was, and I don't know what Dave Cavill was thinking. Maybe he was just caught up in the moment and was just excited and, wow, look at this, is great. Or he was really trying to stick it to Oakland. All I know is the scene at the 2019 wild card at the Coliseum was three times what he showed in that tweet. I mean, you were there that night. I mean, it was unreal how that stadium was and what the city of Oakland can do and what the Oakland fans can do. So the worst part was him not walking back the tweet at all, doing these interviews And the interview that I saw on KTVU, where the interviewee was did a fantastic job. He just kept asking him about it. And Cavill kept going to his speech. The thing that's important to remember is not answering the question, just saying, hey, yeah, it was a bad tweet. Just own it. He would have done so much more goodwill, and he didn't. He went to this political type talk. That doesn't help anything. And then the fight with the media, and I hate to say it, seemed like a page out of the Donald Trump playbook. The media's against us. It's all the media's fault. No. Don't go there. That's what's frustrating. And now you're trying to sell tickets, right? Stadium's opening up again. It's going to be full capacity at the end of the month. You got a good baseball team. What's going to make fans want to buy tickets or put their heart and soul to this team when you, the face of the franchise, is doing what you're doing? I think it's a really bad situation, and that's why I think he kind of turned into the villain.
Yeah, and, you know, let's be fair, too, here, as far as we don't know the intent that Dave Cavill had when he sent that tweet. You know, you're very well. I don't think he was looking to really rub it in the faces of A's fans. Maybe it was geared more toward the Oakland politicians a little bit. So not saying he was purposely trying to do that to A's fans. That's the way it was taken, though. And look, he's put a lot of time. The A's in general have put a lot of time in this Howard Terminal effort. I mean, all the lobbying they've done in Sacramento, all the goodwill they've tried to build on the politics side of it in Sacramento, getting the approvals they've needed. It's not easy to build on the waterfront in California. It's not easy. You got to jump through a lot of hoops, and he's making a lot of the right moves. The A's are making a lot of the right moves as far as trying to make that happen. It's just all about the message you send, how it's going to be portrayed to fans.
Yeah. Right?
Because the fans, you don't want this backlash that you've gotten. And the A's seem to, in a lot of different ways, with a lot of different stories, they always find a way to generate this negative PR, right? Generating the national headlines for all the wrong reasons, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm with you there. I don't think there's anybody who wants the ballpark at Howard Terminal to work more than Dave Cavill and John Fisher. Yeah. They don't want to own a ballpark. I mean, John Fisher does not want to own a ballpark in Las Vegas. I firmly believe that. They want Howard Terminal to work. And, you know, some of the deal memo and the term sheet has been misconstrued. You know, the $955 million or $855 million in tax funds. Well, those funds are only generated if this ballpark actually gets built. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to start. The A's have their $1 billion ballpark that they're privately financing. The development is where the public funds come in, but none of it matters if the ballpark doesn't get built. There's been some messaging on how this all goes down. And some people on social media have been doing a very good job of trying to be very clear with how this stuff works. And other people just want to jump on the negative and say the A's want $900 million in tax money. And that's not really the case.
Right.
I think Cavill might've just gotten fed up with everything too. Hearing him on these interviews, I've never heard him sound as exhausted and as frustrated as he does. You know, there were things out of his control and he's not used to that. I mean, he worked really hard in San Jose to get that stadium built and he made it happen. And so I think these roadblocks, this is what killed, not to say killed Lou Wolf, because Lou Wolf's still alive, but really frustrated Lou Wolf was the process. He used to talk about how much money is being made on the process and it just trying to do anything in California. It just destroyed him, just knocked him back. I think now Cavill's starting to feel that too, and the government and politics and everything else involved. I do firmly believe they want Howard Terminal is their number one choice. They don't want to have to go to Vegas. And I think fans need to remember that. My issue is the Coliseum site not being viable because you bought half of it. You own half of it. I thought that was part of the plan too, that if this Howard Terminal doesn't work, we could do something at the Coliseum site. Why is that changed? I don't understand that stuff.
Yeah, and you know what? I love Howard Terminal as a site. I've liked it all along. I've said, man, if they can make it work there, I'm all for that waterfront ballpark site if they can make it happen. But there's just a lot of difficulties there. A lot of hoops to jump through. The environmental impact report's got to still be voted on. July 20th, I think, is the day the Oakland City Council is going to vote on the term sheet for this ballpark idea. But then after that, they have to vote on the environmental impact reports. There's still a couple of big hurdles to get through. Hopefully in the near future, we get some clarity on what that might mean there. So it's a great concept at Howard Terminal. It's just, it's very difficult to get it done. Difficult. And you saw the difficulties from the get-go when it was first announced, the difficulties that it had. And even before they picked Howard Terminal, when Dave was still, I mean, I did a podcast with him. They were looking at the Peralta site at Laney College. They were looking at Howard Terminal. They were looking at Coliseum. And, you know, Dave Cavill said, we're seriously considering all three of these sites. Howard Terminal is probably going to be the most ambitious and the most difficult, the most iconic site, but the most difficult too, because of all the factors there. They chose Peralta, did not work out. Now, maybe in their research in the past few years, they've just even gotten more soured on the Coliseum maybe, because at one point they were looking at it as a viable site. Now it's not seen as that. So
does that frustrate you? I mean, it frustrates me.
About the Coliseum not being viewed as a site?
Yeah, because beside the fact that you have the transportation and BART and the freeways, yeah, you don't have the ballpark village. I get that. But there's so much land there. And they talk about parking lot stadiums not working. They still work for Dodger Stadium. They still work in Kansas City. They still work in Anaheim. That's not all together true. Yeah, you're not going to make as much money around your ballpark village. Because, yeah, when there's not a game, people probably aren't going to go to that Coliseum site. But there's so much land. You can build a beautiful ballpark with beautiful parking, plenty of transportation options, and make the A's their brand new home. And to say that it's not viable, I don't buy that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Howard Terminal, my mind's number one, definitely the number one option. I could see that. But the Coliseum should, I think, still be viewed as a very viable backup plan, right? Fallback plan. Yeah. That you can go back to. And it's still, despite all the A's, you know, public statements that the team's not for sale, you know, John Fisher's not looking to sell. That's still the one thing always in the back of my mind is if Howard Terminal doesn't work out, you know, and maybe the Vegas thing doesn't come to fruition, maybe all the public money that maybe you think you may get there doesn't come, or it just doesn't happen.
You're not getting any public money city, in Vegas. There's no public city, money.
You know, could they look to sell? Then there's, we've heard of different ownership groups, locally based ownership groups who are interested in the Coliseum site, maybe. I still don't think that's out of the question that eventually the team could be sold to a new ownership group that sees the Coliseum differently and decides we can make it work here. We want to build local. We want to build at the Coliseum. But that's, again, right now the current A's ownership is saying this team is not for sale. That's not at all in our thoughts. But we'll see. You know, the Coliseum not being a viable option is the opinion of this ownership group. It's no panel of economists or business people that have taken official stance saying Coliseum's not viable. That's the position of this ownership group.
Yeah, and Major League Baseball to a point, because they're the ones who also came out with that. And again, it could be all posturing to try and push this through at, on a speedier pace and to get this done. We don't know all the backdoor maneuverings and negotiations that still have to happen.
Right.
I don't like the public relations part of it all. When it's hard enough to sell tickets and get fans into A's games. And now that you're opening the stadium up again with a good team that deserves this fan support.
Yeah.
They're a fun team to watch. And it's hard. It's hard to say, hey, come out and be an A's fan. If you say, well, come out A's fan, but we might be gone in 2024.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is nothing new for A's fans. A's fans are into this kind of pull and tug and being in limbo and having favorite players to root for, but not knowing how long those favorite players will be in an A's uniform. And now it's just a little bit different, you know, rooting for this team that you love being in Oakland, maybe not knowing how long they'll potentially be in Oakland. We'll see. It's unfortunately nothing new, for the A's fan base. So A's fans need to enjoy the on-field product right now. Enjoy the first place team you have right now. Enjoy the potential of this team, maybe hopefully gearing up for another postseason run, perhaps, and hope for the best of the ballpark situation, but just keep the focus on the on-field. That's the only thing I can tell A's fans right now is, keep focused on the team itself and take your enjoyment out of that right now, because you have no control over what the future holds or how this whole thing might unfold.
Yeah. Product on the field, right? That's what we're rooting for. We're rooting for these players and this team, and we just keep going with it. And hopefully they continue to have a successful season and we get to enjoy it. And more fans are going to be able to see it now. And I think it's, you know, you look around baseball and you see some of the stadiums with the bigger capacities and then fans coming back. It's pretty special now to see that. At times, still nervous with a lot of people, and I feel that way, and I'm sure a lot of people do, but it's nice to see people coming back to the ballpark, players getting to hear the fans cheer. It makes a difference.
Yeah, and with that, let's wrap up another episode of the Green and Bold podcast with the A's, about ready to start a 9-game homestand. We'll see Feldy. This team's 18-9 on the road as we speak. Yes. 17-17 at home with 9 games against the Diamondbacks, the Royals, and the Angels, which on paper doesn't seem like an especially imposing slate of 3 opponents coming in. But we'll see if they can get the good times rolling here at home and maybe get a little distance between themselves and the Houston Astros in the standings.
Yeah, it scares me. Arizona coming in, they've lost 17 straight road games. I was really hoping they'd win a game in Milwaukee, right? Yeah. Just so they don't come in this long losing streak, because teams don't lose that many road games in a row. Yeah. That streak's going to end eventually. And you just hope the A's can get through these next 2 games and make sure it's a 19-game road losing streak, which would be the longest since 1985, which is unbelievable to think about. So it makes me a little nervous. But yeah, the A's have a chance to pick up some games against the Diamondbacks and Royals. And weren't the Angels just here? It feels like the Angels were just here. Did they ever leave? Yeah, they're still on BART? Right, they're still trying to get to the stadium? They're
coming right back.
Good time for the A's to get some wins.
Yeah. Good stuff, Feldy. Let's do this again soon, everybody. Thank you for listening. As always, anywhere you find your podcast, you can definitely find the Green and Bold podcast. Listen to us. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We always appreciate that. Thanks for everything, Feldy. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, Joe. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to another episode of the Green and Bold podcast.